you first tell me, Mr. Colby, where and when you were born?
I was born in Woking, November the 20th, 1903.
Who are your parents? Who are your parents?
My parents were Dr. F.E.A. and my mother was Mrs.
So did your family have any city connections?
None at all.
And where did they send you to school?
I went to Charterhouse and Christ Church, Oxford, where I got an honours degree.
What did you read?
English literature.
And did you have any plans for what you would do with your life?
No. My father had three sons, and he said to them, I'll give you all first-class education, and after that it's up to you. And he was well-known a doctor in Woking, and he said to me, what do you want to do? And I said that I want to go somewhere where I've got a chance of making money. And he said, well, it's either the Stock Exchange or Lloyd's. Well, one of his patients at the time was the chairman of Lloyd's, and he said, as I hadn't got any capital, he said he thought it would be better to go into the Stock Exchange. And we lived next door to a very well-known stock jobber, and he got me a job with a small firm called Halfin King, where I went in April 1926, having come down from Oxford in June 25.
What had been the attitude to places like the Stock Exchange among your peers, for example, either at school or at university? Was it regarded as a respectable place in which
yes,
to make one's
absolutely.
Career?
Yes, absolutely. Yes, they all thought it was a very good place to go to.
And what had been the attitude to money in your family? You said that your object was to make money.
Yeah. Well, of course, my elder brother became governor of Nyasaland, and my other brother was an author. But of course, they both died young of cancer, and I am here just very lucky to still be going.
So you entered the Stock Exchange in
April 1926, really. And I was authorised in July 1928.
Could you describe the first firm that you worked with? Was it a small firm?
It was a very small firm. The two partners, they had a desk each. They had a top hat on their desk. They had no office, no Stock Exchange staff. And if somebody rang them up, or they rang somebody up, they would put the top hat on, go down and do the deals, and the senior partner would then write out the contracts. And the office expenses in toto, I know it's a different type of pound, was $3,600 a year in those days. That included everything. All salaries, and of course the rent was sixpence a square foot. I've never forgotten that.
And what kind of things did they have you doing when you
I was
started?
Just a clerk, and I don't think this should be on the record, but I got very friendly with a chap called Mobbs at Oxford, whose father started Sly Estates, and he was also very big in the motor trade. And he was also a top-class bridge player. He was chairman of the Portland Club. And they gave these very big weekend parties at a house about 2 miles from where my parents lived. And everything was betted on. And about 6 weeks before the English Ford Company was floated in 1928, I went there for the weekend, and Edsel Ford was staying there, and I drew him at bridge, and he was playing very high stakes, and I was playing, of course, very low ones, and he was carrying me, and we had every card in the pack, and he made a hell of a lot of money. I mean, I really mean big money, and it didn't make any difference to him. But and he said to me, what do you do for a living? And I said, well, I'm struggling in the Stock Exchange. I can't get anywhere. I'm still in the office, you know. And he said, well, the English Ford Company is being floated in, I think it was 6 weeks' time, and if you apply for them, you can get them in full. It was a public issue, of course. And I said, well, unfortunately, I've got no money. Will it be all right if I tell my firm? And he said, yes. And they went for 30,000 shares at a pound, which was a lot of money, of course, in those days. And they sold them at about, I think it was 11 shillings premium. And I was immediately authorised. that's how it happened. And I got a lot of business in the Fords because Noel Mobbs had given all his agents throughout the country 1,000 shares. And I got all the selling out of that. And of course, that really started me off in a way, because I did a lot in Fords ever since then. I mean, up to certain, during that time in the 30s. And of course, he was chairman of Stuy Estates. And of course, I got quite a lot of business from them. And I was beaten into being broker to Slough by a very well-known bridge player, but I was broker to one of his other companies called United Motor Finance, which is now, well, became Mercantile Credit, and I think is it Lloyd's Bank or somebody, it's one of the banks now. So that was all loss. that's how I really started, but it's quite interesting, pure luck.
When you were authorised, you were then entitled to go into the house.
Yes.
Do you have any early recollections of what that was like, going into the house, or what the
yes,
house
Yes, I
was
do.
Like?
I, when I was, well, it was just as it was for the next 30-odd years, really. There were just broker's stands, and you got friendly with people, and you dealt with them. And, I had one or two particular firms whom I was very friendly with, and of course, I used to deal for them as well. They'll do a lot of their personal dealings for two or three of the firms. So.
And then how long was it before you were taken into a partnership?
Well, what happened was that they were taken over by Laurie Milbank, this small firm. And I wouldn't like this to put this on the record, but the eldest son of the previous firm, the firm was taken over, had left school at 16. And by the time I got there, he was over me, you know, he was senior to me. And, well, they were all awfully mean, that family, and I couldn't stand living there, being with them all the time. And when the manager came in with Laurie Milbank for Christmas 1932, and he said, I've come for give you your Christmas bonus, and he handed me two £1 notes. And so I handed them back to him, and I said, I think somebody's probably deserved these more than I have, and gave notice and to Sir John Laurie. And I was getting £2.50 a year as a senior dealer, which is quite a fair salary in those days. Anyway, to cut a long story short, they offered me £1,000 a year to stay, and God knows what else. And when I said I wasn't interested, it was quite you could all have seen his face. Anyway, there was a chap in the Stock Exchange called Heseltine who said to me, if you ever wanted a job, I'll give you one. And I went to him, I said, do you still want to give me a job? And he said, when do you want to start? And I said, about 3 weeks' time. I said, are you going to pay me anything? And he said, £400 a year, and that's how I started.
What was the name of his firm?
Walter Walker, that was. He was a very clever chap, actually. Very, very, very astute. He started a telephone rentals, a firm called Telephone Rentals. And he said to me, if you ever got any money, put it into land. He bought 1,200 acres about 2 miles east of Basingstoke, built a house, and built a drive about half a mile long, and the whole thing stood him in for 25,000 quid. I mean, they were good pounds. And he was a very good golfer, and he had a hole about 180 yards on his estate, and beautiful green and everything. And you knew for a fact that he was probably going to get a two because he was a very good golfer. And you always had to go and have a go at him, and he'd always put money on, he always won.
Well, the stock exchange had just come through the Depression at this point.
Yes, it was in the middle of a depression, of course.
What were conditions like at this time?
Well, there was very little doing, and everybody was fairly depressed. And of course, the Daily Express had a great campaign to open the stock exchange on a Saturday. And this happened the Saturday before we went off the gold standard. And of course, when we went off the gold standard, the gilt edge market, all the jobbers in the gilt edge market were insolvent. And of course, there was Halfhead, who was in Laurie Milbank, who was Halfhead and King. He was on the committee with the Bank of England to solve the position, which they did, of course. But when we went off the gold standard, the foreigners were selling it gilts on the Saturday where we opened. And you see, in those days, if the gilt market went up or down a 16th, it was almost a crisis, because it went down about 5 points, you see, and it was never happened before. And it was a terrific thing. And there was a kind of moratorium in the gilt market, I think, in those days for a bit. The Bank of England stepped in, and it was all done. It all came out in the end, all right. But actually, at that day, I believe every single jobber was insolvent in the gilt market. And they gave up opening it after about six, I think it was opened about six times or something like that, six Saturdays, and they gave it up.
Were there many hemorrhings arising from this?
I don't think there were, no, over that. I wouldn't like to guarantee it, but yes. I don't think there were.
Was it the jobbers who were bearing the brunt of these?
The jobbers were in the gilt market, yes, they were all virtually insolvent, all the jobbers, after we went off the gold standard. I don't think the other jobbers particularly badly hit, because I don't think the market was all that bad, if I remember rightly, but it was the gilts that happened.
Was there sufficient business for broking firms and jobbing firms to?
Not really. There wasn't enough. There was very little turnover.
Were people having to look outside the stock exchange for additional income?
No, I wouldn't have said that. No, I wouldn't have said so. No, and then of course it started picking up when the American market started going. See, I think the bottom of the American slump was something like 1932. Then things started picking up, and then there was a lot of business.
Well, how would you describe the firm that you now joined, Walter Walker? Was it a very similar firm to the one that you had previously been with?
Yes, roughly, but bigger, of course, a bit bigger. Not a tremendous lot bigger. They were all, you know, so different today, what it is today. You know, I mean, here they're dealing on somebody else's money. Therefore, they're not quite so careful as they were in the old days when we were dealing with our own money. I mean, if we had a £100 loss, it was a kind of disaster. Here, I think nothing.
Did you specialise in any particular stocks?
No, I did anything that came my way, really. I had quite a large, after the war, of course, I had known the boss of Rensburg very well in Liverpool, and for about 10 years I did all their business in London. And also I met a chap in the war who was a firm in Glasgow, and they were a firm of insurance jobbers in Glasgow, and I used to undo their business for them in London. And I did all the Polycell business. I don't know, you've probably heard of Polycell. Have you heard of Polycell? Well, it's a kind of paint filler. And it started off with a capital of £500, and it was sold, that was in 48, and it was sold to the wallpaper company in 1960, 2 for 16 million, which is, you know, a lot of money in those days.
Well, thinking about early in your career, would there have been at any point that you would have contemplated becoming a jobber, or did it never occur to you?
No, I never wanted to be a jobber.
What would you say?
I was offered a job. I was offered a job in one of the biggest firms in the stock exchange, which I turned down.
Can you remember which that one?
Aykroyd and Smithers.
And did they approach you?
They approached me, yes.
And what were your reasons for turning it
down?
Well,
I'd got a good business going, and I didn't think that I particularly wanted it. I've always been rather a lone wolf, I'm afraid. And I have always been a lone wolf, shall I say, and still am. And I didn't want really to be part of a team, if you really want to know, really, quite honestly.
And was this early in your career?
That would have been about after the war.
I see. Thinking about the 1930s, how would you contrast the jobbers in that period with what subsequently, for example, when the big mergers began to take place? Was it a very different kind of system?
I don't think it was all that different. They were, you know, you dealt with friends all the time, all the way through, really. I mean, they were personal friends of yours. Now you just lift the phone up and you don't really know who is at the other end of it. That's the trouble.
Were there a greater number of jobbers in the market?
Oh, hell of a lot. I don't know how many there were, but I could... there were hundreds. Then it was whittled down to about 7, as you know. But there were literally dozens and dozens of two-man firms with, I should say, damn little capital.
The fact that there were hundreds and hundreds, did that make any difference to the kind of things you could do as a broker? For example,
not really, although, of course, you had more... I was inclined to deal with the big job, people like Ferguson, Clark, and Haddo and Turner, and Kitchen, Baker, Mason, and all that lot. But, you know, occasionally I dealt with the small firms if it suited them or suited me.
In what circumstances would it suit you? In what circumstances would it suit you to deal with a smaller firm?
Well, if they were making the wrong price, I I was a very keen dealer, and I knew the market extremely well. And, jobbers make different prices. I used to go around the market. They used to call me an arch squirt, but I mean, they were.
Now, I've come across that word squirt before. Could you explain for the benefit of the tape what exactly a squirt was?
Well, I suppose a squirt was a chap who would go around the market and if he could, he'd deal on a choice price.
Mm-hmm. And about how many jobbers would you feel you had to see before you'd got the touch?
Well, I suppose about half a dozen, I suppose, really. You see, there were about eight. I'm not talking about the gilt market. I'm talking about the industrial market. There were 8 to 10 biggish firms, who I would always go around and check the price with. You see, when I was dealing for Rendsburg, it was very, very competitive, and you really had to get your commission out of your dealing. If you understand what I mean. I mean, they would have, if they'd, I mean, after one wasn't allowed to deal for the country, their dealings, they were the jobber's friend because they didn't know really the touch like I did. They were on the phone and they were very difficult to check it on the phone, 7 or 8 jobbers. Well, they couldn't do it. I mean, they were absolute bonanza, in my opinion.
So, in that case, were there also brokers who simply didn't try and get the touch?
Yes. Oh, yes.
And so would they have fairly established relationships with particular jobbing firms who they went to regularly?
Yes, I think they would. But you see, there were some people in those days, I'm not going to name anybody, but who had, say, a friend in the oil market, and he had, say, he came down the market with half a dozen orders round the market. He would give these orders to this chap, who would go and deal, and there would be two turns, in other words. But there was a chap in our firm who did that, but we clamped on that because, it was ridiculous.
Where did you, as a broker, get your the information upon which you either based your advice to your clients?
Well, of course, it was so different in those days. If you had a query, you went to see a jobber, and they told you. You kept in touch with everything. Yes. Really, it was so much easier. Now I read. I don't know what's going on till I read the Evening Standard in the evening.
Mm. And did you try and cover all the markets, or
yes,
keep a general idea?
All the markets, everyone.
And this didn't feel a particular burden on you?
Not the slightest, no. I didn't do any big gilt business until after the war, when I dealt for the Liverpool Building Society. I did a lot then, but of course they've been taken over by somebody, so I don't get anything from them anymore.
Again, thinking about the jobbers generally during the 1930s, did they feel as if they were a different breed to the brokers, a different kind of person?
Oh yes, definitely.
And how would you describe that?
Well, it's very difficult to describe it, isn't it, really? There were two different types entirely. That's about all you can say.
Do you feel they came from different social backgrounds?
No, not the slightest.
Did they have a different cast of mind?
I think they probably had a different class of mind. I think it was probably generated by the fact that they were jobbers. I don't think they started with a different class of mind, not particularly anyway. But it was, you can't imagine how different it was in those days. You see, very few firms in the early 30s had any stock exchange stock. The partners did all the dealing, like they did in Half Eaton King. They just put the top hats on and went down, dealt, came back and took it all. And I don't think until I got to Laurie Milbank, where I was dealing. Well, of course, I was dealing in Half Eaton King, but I was about the only office staff. I was the only floor staff that Half Eaton King had.
Do any particular issues of stock or particular offers of stock stand out in the memory from this period? For example, there was
Morris Motors, of course. That was the big thing. Yes. That was the way you could buy them from one part of the firm at, I think it was 42 shillings, and sell them at the other half at 47.6, if you wanted to. Well, I don't think they liked that very much. I mean, that was the biggest, I think, probably. And of course, the English Ford Company, as far as I was concerned, was a big issue. Mm. Those are the two. English Ford was 28. I'm not certain what Morris was. You don't know, do you? No.
I think it was around, as he said.
It was around, somewhere around there.
Yes.
Those were the two biggest ones I remember.
Do you have any particular memories of the day of the Morris issue? For example, I believe there was a great crush of brokers coming into
crush.
Deal.
Oh, yes.
And there were stories in the Financial Times about brokers coming up and dealing, fainting, recovering, finding the price has changed and dealing again.
Well, of course, the best story of all, I don't think it's true, but you can't imagine what the rubber market was like in those days. In the stock exchange, in the rubber boom. It was unbelievable, the crowds. And of course they have the story, the old story was that one of the elderly chaps died at 10 o'clock in this crash, and they didn't know anything about it until 3:30 when they all went out and he fell down. I think that's an apocryphal. But you can't imagine what it was like, that rubber boom. Unbelievable. You've probably heard it from other people, have you?
I've heard it referred to.
It really was quite fantastic. You see, I came into the end of the first rubber boom, and there was another one in the 50s. Mm. And I think the 1926 boom, rubber went up to £4 a pound and fell to about fourpence. Mm. you can imagine what happened there. And Halfhead had a big connection with the rubber, and I went down to Mincing Lane for an hour every day when I, after I'd been authorised.
And did you trade?
Yeah, I got orders from people in Mincing Lane, and then I was very he was very friendly with Lewis and Pete, who were a big, and I used to kind of have my headquarters there, and used to phone up the orders to the firm, which I'd got down in the rubber market. But then they all went bust in the end, almost on.
In those circumstances, when there was a boom, or when prices were fluctuating up and down, did you feel as if you knew what was going on, or did you feel that the jobbers were the ones who had the wood?
No, you knew what was going on, more or less. But, you know, it was very hectic, tremendously hectic. But you just had to push your way in, that was that, in those days.
And did you have many jobbers sharing in the business? Would you have new jobbers coming in because it was an active market?
I don't think so, no. There were, if we're talking about the rubber market, there were about 10, I suppose, altogether. They were all tremendously busy.
Do you recall any of the political crises of the period having an effect on the stock exchange, the Abyssinian crisis in 1935 or Czechoslovakia in 1938?
I remember very well Kennedy being murdered. That came through at about 3:30, just as the American market was opening. You see, there was a very big American market in Shorter's Court, tremendous American market. And I remember that very well. And of course, I remember the death of King George VI, where they stopped dealing. But I can't really recall any tremendous crisis. Munich, I suppose, was a... I don't think the market... You know, I didn't feel a crisis at Munich, although everybody thought war was coming.
What did you do during the war?
I was in the RAF from December 1939 until... August 45, where being elderly and having gone in early, I got out early.
And how did your firm, or most stock exchange firms, fare during the war when presumably a lot of their partners and clerks went?
Yes, they did. They seemed to fare comparatively well. I think there was quite a lot of business. I absolutely divorced myself from the stock exchange for the whole time. I never took the slightest bit of interest in it. But as soon as I got back, I was right in the swing. Because they rang me up as soon as I got and asked me whether I could come up immediately, which I did pretty well. And we were tremendously busy.
So at the end of the war, you simply didn't contemplate pursuing another career?
No, not the slightest, no. No, I had to try and rebuild my business because a lot of the clients had gone to people who hadn't gone to the war. Mm-hmm. It's almost like that.
What were conditions like 1946, 47, a very difficult time economically for the country?
They were very busy in the stock exchange. Very busy times indeed. Although we had a Labour government, I think probably it didn't make much difference. We were very busy, tremendously busy.
And was the house essentially the same kind of place that it had been during the 30s, the same customs, the same practical
Absolutely.
Jokes?
I mean, I can't believe it. I was away 5 years, really. Impossible.
How would you have described the stock exchange as an institution? Was it a very conservative place? Did it have a particular set of customs that would have seemed quite arcane to the outside?
I think it
world?
Was a pretty closed shop in those days. There was no gallery or anything, and nobody really knew anything about it. I think the average chap in the street didn't know much about it. It was very much a place for, I suppose, for rich clients to dabble around in. And you see, there were an awful lot of very, very good private clients in those days who all disappeared. I mean, I had some very fine private clients. Marvellous business. it's altered tremendously. I mean, it's all institutional now, as you know. And it was all, I mean, there was practically no institutional business when I first went in there at all. It was all private clients.
And were there particular markets or particular areas of the stock market that you would have advised people to invest in rather than avoid? For example, would you have recommended gilt stocks as opposed to rubber stocks or
money
stocks?
Well, of course, I've been 100% against fixed interest ever since I went into the stock exchange. And I've never had a gilt, and very few of my clients in those days had them. Mm. And I think probably that one of the, I don't say the cleverest thing I ever did, but one of them was my mother had not a big trust, but I did have a trust. Everything was in war loan. And my elder brother and I, this was 1947, I think, were the trustees. And I rang him up and said, I think it's a ridiculous price of war loan. I think we ought to sell them and put it into equities. And we sold war loan at 107¾. That was about the best deal I think I've ever done in my life. And put the money into first class equities. And of course, it saved her life completely. I mean, she was comparably